This is Yin Radio. Welcome to Yin Radio. My name is Tara K. Howe, and I'm your host today. And I'm very excited because on today's show, we are featuring an interview with Nalini Nadkarni, the 2015 recipient of the William Julius Wilson Award for the Advancement of Social Justice. And she's widely known as the Queen of the Forest Canopy. Nadkarni is a professor of biology at the University of Utah. She specializes in studying rainforest canopy organisms and their interactions in tropical rainforests. She has innovated science engagement and conservation programs that bring lectures, experiential learning, and conservation projects to non-traditional public audiences, such as faith-based groups, urban youth, artists, modern dancers, rap singers, legislators, and incarcerated men and women. Nadkarni has written more than 110 scientific articles and 3 scholarly books, including Between Earth and Sky, Our Intimate Connections to the Trees. Other recent awards include the National Science Foundation Public Service Award, the American Association for the Advancement of Science Award for Public Engagement, and the Archie Carr Medal for Conservation. Her work is supported by the National Science Foundation and the National Geographic Society. She earned her doctoral degree at the University of Washington and has served on the faculty at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Nalini will be in our area in another week to receive the William Julius Wilson Award for the Advancement of Social Justice and to give her presentation, Not Such Strange Bedfellows, Bringing Science, Nature, and Nature Imagery to Prisons. That starts at 7:30 p.m. in the Compton Union Building, the CUB Auditorium, which again is on the WSU campus. I'm going to play for you an excerpt from a TED Talk she gave in 2010 that was called Life Science in Prison.
In the year 2007, I started a partnership with the Washington State Department of Prisons. Working with 4 prisons, we began bringing science and scientists, sustainability and conservation projects to 4 state prisons. We give science lectures, and the men here are choosing to come to our science lectures instead of watching television or weightlifting. That, I think, is movement. We partnered with the Nature Conservancy for inmates at Stafford Creek Correctional Center to grow endangered prairie plants for restoration of relic prairie areas in Washington State. That, I think, is movement. We worked with the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife to grow endangered frogs, the Oregon spotted frog, for later release into protected wetlands. That, I think, is movement. And just recently, we've begun to work with those men who are segregated in what we call supermax facilities. They've incurred violent infractions by becoming violent with guards and with other prisoners. They're kept in bare cells like this for 23 hours a day. When they have meetings with their review boards or mental health professionals, they're placed in immobile booths like this. For 1 hour a day, they're brought to these bleak and bland exercise yards. And although we can't bring trees and prairie plants and frogs into these environments, we are bringing images of nature into these exercise yards, putting them on the wall so at least they get contact with visual images of nature.
I wanted to also give you some further insight into Nadkarni's amazing passion for her life's work. So what I'm going to do is read you a selection from the book I mentioned, Between Earth and Sky. And again, what you heard there was Nalini speaking in her TED Talk about the presentation she's going to be giving here at WSU. But to really get to know her, I think you need to get this whole picture of this very passionate person that she is and her absolute devotion to what she does. So she is speaking of her younger years in this excerpt, and she says, "I loved the challenge of untangling the endless puzzles I encountered in nature. Like veterinarians with dogs and obstetricians with the soon-to-be-born, ecologists explore their subjects without the benefit of mutually intelligible speech. They rely instead on their own observations and the written observations of others, bound in books and archived in libraries. The new sciences library at Brown University was a tall, imposing structure that I sought to make familiar. Early in my senior year, I spent a night there, hiding out in the bathroom with my sleeping bag until the doors were locked and the custodians departed. Starting on the top floor, I walked slowly through the stacks, astronomy to zoology, touching the book spines, dipping into a tome here, a journal there. As dawn broke, I found myself on the ground floor, tired but happy to have made at least a fleeting acquaintance with the realm of science as represented in its printed form. What I absorbed that night confirmed what I had learned from Dr. Wage. Science, a word that comes from the Latin scire, is to know to the fullest extent possible, and it's one good way to understand and communicate what interests me about the world. So I joined the world of science to study trees and forests. And I was thinking as I read this, I'm sure many of us have had similar fantasies, you know, whether it's being alone with free rein in a library or a museum or even just the daringness to experience something like this. But most of that, you know, never gets acted on. And as you can tell from this passage, and I think you'll find as a congruent thread in all her endeavors, is that Nalini Nadkarni is that person that acts upon her visions. Moreover, she acts upon her visions in a way that is open and responsive to all the feedback she receives. She's constantly observing and constantly engaged in dialogue. Nadkarni, for me, is the epitome of an ecological ethos, an integrative web of actors that seek to know one another and find balance in the reciprocal experiences and knowledges shared in order to maintain that web. I have another clip here from Nadkarni's 2009 TED Talk, which was called Conserving the Canopy, so that you can hear in her voice that awe and wonder when she describes her work.
Trees are wonderful arenas for discovery. Because of their tall stature, their complex structure, the biodiversity they foster, and their quiet beauty. I used to climb trees for fun all the time, and now, as a grown-up, I have made my profession understanding trees and forests through the medium of science. The most mysterious part of forests is the upper tree canopy, and Dr. Terry Irwin in 1983 called the canopy the last biotic frontier. I'd like to take you all on a journey up to the forest canopy and share with you what canopy researchers are asking and also how they're communicating with other people outside of science.
As I mentioned, that was from a TED Talk in 2009 called Conserving the Canopy, and I definitely recommend you go and look that up. Conserving the Canopy TED Talk, should find it. Nalini Nadkarni, her name is spelled N-A-L-I-N-I, and Nadkarni is N-A-D-K-A-R-N-I, and it's just every single facet of it is inspirational, and you get a really good sense of, again, what her life's work been, and then how she comes to be where she is now working with the prison system, which is, of course, what our interview is about today. So Nalini and I had a phone interview about a week and a half ago now, and it was just, again, to speak with her in person was absolutely wonderful. Again, I'm here interviewing, well, we're going to present actually an interview with Nalini Nadkarni that was done earlier by phone. And let's see. So just as a reminder then, Bringing Science and Nature to Prison is the presentation she'll be giving on the 30th of this month at WSU at the Cub, and that starts at 7:30. That's open to the public. And of course, we're looking at what this amazing ecologist has done, and she's coming here to receive the Social Justice Award. And I find that actually very interesting, and that's part of what we discuss in the interview as well, is how that comes to be. So I present for you here Dr. Nadkarni in an interview with Yin Radio.
Sure. So I was sort of delighted and surprised that I'm the recipient for the 2015 Award for Social Justice that's being given by the Washington State University. And I guess I'm sort of surprised because I don't think of myself as an expert in social justice. I see myself as a scientist, and yet I do think that I guess can be classified as social justice because I very much believe that an understanding of science and of the world through the lens of science really belongs to everybody. I find it a very useful way of coming to understand the world. And I think there are a lot of people in the world who don't have access to science in the way that I do as a university professor and someone who's been to college and has gotten higher degrees. So I think that my work is being recognized because one of the public groups that I focus on are incarcerated men and women. That is, people who often have not had a good education in science or who've had bad experiences with science education, or at the present, their lives because of the legal constraints and physical constraints, really don't have access to science education. So my efforts over the last decade, or some of my efforts over the last decade, have really been about trying to bring together what seems to be very strange bedfellows, which mm-hmm. are the science community and what science has to offer with the people, the corrections community, and people who are incarcerated. So my talk is really going to be about kind of what the inspiration for that was, why I think it's important as a scientist to offer what I know about science and what I know about nature, and to try to bring to my colleagues, my science colleagues, what incarcerated people might have to offer in terms of insights into nature and science. And then to sort of talk about where this is taking my colleagues and me, where we see this being useful in the world of correction, which has, you know, so many things going wrong with it in this time of mass incarceration. How can scientists contribute to improving that? Certainly it needs improvement, and education and exposure to science and nature, offering opportunities to contribute to conservation, I think, is one small way that we can go about doing that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Are you able to tell me a little bit more about maybe your moment when you really first realized that you wanted to bring science and nature into the prisons?
Yeah. I don't think of it as a moment.
Okay.
I actually had no sort of historical connection to imprisonment or incarceration. You know, nobody in my family has been incarcerated. I've never been incarcerated. But I've always been aware, ever since I was a little girl, of the, you know, sort of the injustice of our justice system, of the fact that it just seemed wrong somehow that people would be locked up and kept from society and not be able to do anything when they're in prison. That just seemed like sort of the wrong picture. So somehow, always in the back of my mind, there was this sense that someday I'd like to do something about incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
But I never took a career path that took me into corrections or social work or social justice. I love nature and I love science, and that's what I ended up pursuing. But it always seemed to me that, you know, in the back of my mind, there was this little voice that said, you know, someday I want you to connect science with incarceration. And it was actually, there was an ecological problem I was working with back in 2004. I was living in the Pacific Northwest. I was teaching at the Evergreen State College. And I became aware of this, the issue of moss collecting, of collecting mosses that grow on trees and branches in the Pacific Northwest old growth forests for the horticulture trade. You know, if you go into a florist shop, you see these mosses that the florists put around their little pots of plants and so forth. And it turns out all those mosses are collected from old growth forests. And I did some research, and I mean, part of what the ecological research that I've done has shown that those mosses and canopy dwelling plants are really important for the functioning, the healthy functioning of these ecosystems. Birds use them for nesting materials, insects use them to burrow into, they collect nutrients and rain from atmospheric sources. So I knew they were important ecologically, and I also did research and found out that when people remove mosses from trees, it takes a very long time for them to grow back, like 2 or 3 decades.
Mm.
So clearly, this moss collecting is not a sustainable operation. So I thought, well, I can't stop people from harvesting mosses, so maybe I can learn how to grow mosses, and that would relieve this pressure of collecting from these wild ecosystems. But at the time, I didn't have students working with me, and I thought, well, who could help me learn how to grow these mosses? Because nobody knew how to grow mosses. They all collected them out of the wild. And that's when it sort of clicked, and I thought, maybe prisoners could, because they have a lot of time, they often have a lot of space, it doesn't take sharp tools, you know, to grow mosses. So maybe prisoners could be my partners in learning how to grow these mosses. And so I started approaching the state prisons in my state and just saying, you know, could some of the men and women who are behind bars here, like, help me learn how to grow these mosses? And I got back 2 or 3, you know, superintendents who looked at me like I was crazy and said, like, who the hell are you? What are you talking about? But there was this one wonderful superintendent at a small men's minimum security prison, the Cedar Creek Corrections Center, just about 30 minutes from my college, and so I could easily drive down there. And he said, well, you know, it can't hurt, and maybe it'll keep the guys busy. So sure, why not? Let's give it a try. So I got my mosses, I collected them from the forest, and I presented them to these men in prison, and they were so eager to be part of a research project that would actually protect these mosses in old growth forests. And so for 18 months, we worked together. They helped develop the study design. They separated the mosses into samples. We hung some up hanging. We put some in flats. And they couldn't do everything. Like, we couldn't bring drying ovens and balances, you know, to weigh the mosses into this prison. But they could do a big part of it. And so they really became full participants in this ecological research project. And at the end of 18 months, I had my answer. I knew which species of mosses that grew the fastest. And they were very happy with it because they felt that they had shifted their own self-identity from being like useless, stupid prisoners to contributors and participants in really important scientific work and conservation. And the superintendent was really happy because the men were occupied, they were working together, they were gaining skills that might be useful for employment, you know, in the future of when they got out. So it was really a win-win-win situation, and they asked me for more projects, so I started a science lecture series, and I began bringing in fellow faculty to give talks about their ecological research, and I started bringing in conservation groups, and they began teaching the men how to rear endangered species, like the Oregon spotted frog and the Taylor checkerspot butterfly, and species of prairie plants that were then released or planted for restoration projects, you know, on the outside. And so we began realizing that this was a partnership, a collaboration amongst groups that individually had needs that the other institutions could satisfy. Mm-hmm. And for corrections and prisoners to be involved with conservation projects that were helping the earth was, I think, really the sort of, the sort of transformative thing that happened there, that I hadn't expected that to be so important to the inmates, but it really was. And so they were contributing to something that we couldn't do, which was raise all of these animals and plants. We were providing education and a sense of purpose, mm-hmm. and the conservationists were providing the expertise and how to grow these animals and plants. So it began this, what we call now the Sustainability in Prisons Project, which is now in 95 different prisons across the country. And we were really all of us, I think, were deeply satisfied with this give and take between institutions that at first glance don't seem to go together at all. And so that's why I said it wasn't really social justice that was the pusher of this. Mm-hmm. It was something academic. It was my desire to educate and bring nature to these guys. It was the desire to have these endangered species grown for replenishing the earth. So we weren't thinking about social justice. We were thinking about how can each of us get our needs met by partnering with these very different organizations.
Right. So one of the beautiful things about that, I think, though, is that really you're speaking about a fundamental aspect of ecology and that interconnected web that we're all a part of. So how beautiful. And of course, it makes perfect sense then with that focus that is where social justice comes from.
Yes, I think you're right. I think that's absolutely right. And again, I started it sort of blindly. I just sort of followed my gut, you know, and it wasn't an intentional thing. But now that we've had this 10 years or 12 years of experience with this and with partners, with discussions, with conferences, with exchanges, we're beginning to now digest and understand the processes that have underlain this.
Right.
Even though we didn't start out thinking, oh, let's create this web of interaction, how beautiful that will be. It was very much an organic growth. And just like, you know, growing a garden, there are weeds and there are failures to germinate. And so there are plenty of failures along the way. I don't mean to paint this as this perfect project. And it was enormously difficult in certain ways to make these sort of bureaucratic leaps to overcome the barriers of academia, of corrections, and of conservation, all of which have huge barriers that people have to get over in terms of bureaucracy, in terms of rules, in terms of precedence, in terms of culture. I mean, there were just people think differently in different spheres of society. But I think that the beauty of what transpired allowed us to overcome and have patience with these barriers that we were constantly sort of not fighting against, but trying to understand how to overcome.
Right. Right. And it's, you know, it's beautiful because I've listened to two of your TED Talks, and it seems to me, and through time, it really seems that your excitement and your passion for what you do, that your ability to then follow through on that and look for these resources and continue on, that, you know, you really are showing through example, then these models and through the willingness to work together. So when I hear you, I'm excited, you know, absolutely wondering what's going to come out of all of this. In terms, you know, because everything goes through, like you say, it's organic phase, and then there's a more structural element, but that, you know, your willingness to stick to that seems to be really prevalent in all the years of work that you've done, which is another question I had for you, is if you wanted to maybe let our listeners know a little more about some of your background. You have a really fascinating life.
I do. And it started, you know, when I was because, you know, and people said, like, how the hell do you have these ideas of bringing together these bizarre groups, and how do you make it work? And, you know, I always attribute it to my dear parents, who, my dad was from India. He was a Hindu. He was a scientist. He was a very quiet man. And he came over to come to graduate school to the U.S. and ended up staying here. And my mother, on the other hand, was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. She was an Orthodox Jew. Her parents came from Russia. She studied languages. She was very demonstrative and very outgoing. And so I, you know, my siblings and I, there were five of us, grew up in this home in Bethesda, Maryland, you know, some white suburbia where there were no other Indians. There were no other, you know, sort of exotic families like ours. But we just sort of grew up, you know, feeling and understanding and living the sense that, of course, a Hindu and a Jew can live together. Of course, a language person and a science person can live together. Of course, a quiet person and a loud person can live together. And it wasn't always harmonious. I mean, it was a sort of a chaotic family. But the bottom line, I think, the gift that my parents gave me was this understanding that the essence of each religion is really the same. The essence of each culture is really the same. And if you can distill that essence and see it and understand it and get it and respect it, then there's no problem in communicating or interacting or partnering with that other group. And so I do feel I can knock on a prison door and ask the superintendent, you know, how about we grow mosses together? Or I could knock on a church door and I can ask, how about if I give a sermon about truth and spirituality at your pulpit? Not pushing science, but to say, I read your Bible, I read your Quran, I read your Talmud, and I see that there are all kinds of references to trees and forests that are full of respect and full of importance. So if you believe in the Bible, then you have to believe that trees are important and valuable in all ways in your culture. So I think that when people feel like, how do you do that? How do you go talk to rap singers or to legislators? I think that it's because I have come to understand, both from my parents and through these experiences, that, in fact, at our essence, each human being is just a human being. And if we can relate one-to-one with that knowledge and that certainty and that faith, then we can really work the miracle, which is manifested in this, you know, what I see is this huge, bald, you know, shaven-headed, tattooed guy who's a murderer who's taking really good care of this endangered frog. Yep. And that's a miracle, and yet it's not a miracle, because really what we are is human to human, even frog to human. I mean, we're all pretty much the same thing.
Right.
And if we can just remember that, I guess that's really what social justice is about, too, is that we're all kind of equal.
Absolutely. I love how you just put all that together, and I couldn't agree with you more. That's absolutely, and that comes through. It absolutely comes through in your work and in your talks, I think, in your demeanor. And like you said, the fact that you know you can go to any of these spaces, and the point is you're connecting on that level. So that is wonderful. So how about then for you, nature itself, when, how, where did that come in to really be also a fundamental relationship for you?
Yeah, that's another good question. And again, I will have to go back to my childhood, as so many people do when they're conservationists or they study biology. They you ask them, like, why do you do this? You don't earn very much money. Why are you so dedicated? And almost everybody who is in conservation or who is studying biology says, well, when I was a kid, you know, my dad used to take me fishing, or I used to go hiking with my parents. And I was the same way. My parents had 2.5 acres of land, and they had these wonderful trees in their yard. There were these 8 maple trees that lined my parents' driveway. And maybe it was my sort of that chaotic family background that I mentioned before of, you know, my house was just full of the, you know, dogs and cats and people and homework and chores and everything else. And so my place, what I considered my place, was up in a tree. That I'd come home from school, I'd grab a snack, I'd bring my book, and I'd go up one of those 8 maple trees. And so in those trees, I found my place. I found peace, I found quiet, I found squirrels to watch, I found the dynamics of the leaves turning green and then turning yellow and then falling, and then, you know, so I felt a sense of time and I felt a sense of place. And I think, you know, at that time I didn't know the field of ecology even existed. I didn't aspire to being an ecologist because I didn't even know about it. But I wanted somehow to protect trees because they protected me. You know, that was a safe place for me. It was a good place for me. It was a quiet place for me. And I thought, oh, I'll be a forest ranger when I grow up. I'll work for a national park. And then when I went to college and I began studying biology, I learned about this field of ecology, which was really the study of plants and animals and their relationship to the environment. And my ecology professors were spending time out, you know, in the woods and taking notes and making measurements and writing papers and making a living by studying trees and soils and birds and so forth. And so that's when I realized, oh, there's a place, there's a professional place for me, which is coming to understand trees and forests from this sort of intellectual standpoint, this academic standpoint. And that's where I began to sort of root myself. And that's really what I've done for the last 35 years professionally, is to understand trees and forests from an academic standpoint. And it's really been in the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years that I've realized seeing destruction of forests and seeing overconsumption of forest products and seeing how people are not aware of the miracle that trees are, that I've also, in addition to studying trees, have taken on activities that allow me to present trees to people in ways that might make them more aware and better stewards of trees and forests.
Right.
So I guess it went from childhood love of trees to a desire to understand them to now a desire to communicate that understanding to all kinds of people.
And I love the way you said it, because you became the tree yourself with a metaphor of being, I don't know how much you consider metaphor or just quite reality. I take it as quite real, but that rootedness, which in one of the TED Talks I watched, you spoke about the stasis in the roots, but in how that allows the branches so much movement. And even just in thinking of your work, you can see that. You can see all the areas you've been able to reach into, it seems, as a result of. So, again, just such a profound connection by the sounds of it.
Yeah, I totally believe in metaphors. I use metaphors all the time because I think they help me and other people understand complex ideas. And everybody can say, oh, yeah, trees are just stuck in the ground. They're rude. They never move. They're static. Well, that's like what people think about prisoners. You know, oh, they're stuck. They're bad. They've done bad things. They'll never be good. They'll never reform. They'll just keep repeating. And then you have to say, but you know what? Trees are rude. Yes, they are. They're stuck. But it depends on where on the tree you look. And if you stop looking at just the trunk being stuck on the ground and start looking up, I mean, anybody who's ever climbed a tree knows. Or even if you just lie on your back and look up on a tree, you know, look up at a tree's foliage on a windy day, you know those trees that are moving like crazy. And so I think if we stop just looking at the static trunk of a prisoner and say, where is it that we can look in that man or that woman who's been incarcerated, and where can we help them find movement? Maybe it's helping them grow frogs or grow prairie plants or learn a skill or better articulate the emotions inside themselves. Then maybe there's a chance that there can be movement away from what they're stuck in or what they have been stuck with. And it's not just prisoners, it's people with addictions, it's people with habits. It's so many of us that are stuck in the ways that we think, the ways that we are. And so I just have this very hopeful feeling that there is the possibility of movement, and prisoners might be the most extreme, But really, it's all of us. It is all of us. And trying to help people and help ourselves to find mechanisms towards movement, I think, is something that is a lifelong endeavor that we must never stop doing that.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, you're, again, just coming back to the concepts of interchange, and when you describe for yourself first being in the tree, and the notion of how you felt that protection from the tree and wanted to come back and return that. So as I hear you speaking, I also think of some of the concepts we use in applied ecopsychology, which is a field of study that I'm engaged in. And again, it's very much about having those relationships, one-on-one relationships with the more than human world, that, and the wisdom inherent in that, which is all the wisdom you're bringing to this conversation today about that interconnectedness and about the various facets of all of us that are present. Uh-huh. Right? So I am just loving hearing this.
Well, great. You are a great interviewer.
Well, you're just wonderful on all levels. This is fantastic. So I'm wondering if there's, anything else that you wanted to speak to, or if you wanted to highlight. I mean, it's really interesting, actually, some of the things you have done in terms of some of the dancing in the trees and the other elements you've brought into play. I'm definitely curious how you experienced the canopy in, you know, when you really got up there for the first time. I'm wondering how high you got to go, all those types of things. So anywhere you might want to go in there.
Yeah. So, again, as a kid, climbing trees, I was just climbing trees, hands and feet and so forth.
Right.
And I never really got all that high. But when I learned, when I decided to study the forest canopy, that this was back as a graduate student. And, of course, as a graduate student, you have to find an area where you can make an original contribution to science. You have to discover something new or some new interaction or describe some new species or some new way of understanding what's gone before. That's what the PhD dissertation is all about. So when I was in the tropical rainforest as a graduate student, and I sort of looked up at the canopy and I went like, oh my God, you know, look at all those plants growing up there. There are bromeliads and ferns and orchids. And you know, I asked my major professors, like, tell me what's going on up there. And they said, you know, we really don't know much about what's going on up there because it's not very safe to climb up there and nobody climbs up there. We just kind of, you know, it's part of the forest, but so forget about it. But
wow.
But I encountered someone who was using mountain climbing techniques, a guy named Don Perry, to get up to there to study pollination biology of the canopy trees. And I just begged him to please tell me, you know, teach me how to climb using these boat techniques. So he did, and I sort of never looked back. It gave me the power of moving up safely and non-destructively into the forest canopy. And I remember the first time I sort of ascended into this big, tall tropical tree, 125 feet above the ground, and I just started screaming with delight because, you know, here I was suspended on this skinny rope, you know, no thicker than my thumb, with the climbing gear that, you know, pretty light, it's pretty unobtrusive, and yet I was getting higher and higher under my own power, and I started hearing the insects in the canopy and hearing different birds and seeing the forest from this different perspective. And I just realized, you know, that my life was being transformed because I had found a place where I could study and feel happy and feel safe and feel like this is my place, this is my time.
Mm-hmm.
And so for 35 years now, I've been going back to the canopy to really ask questions of the plants and animals that live up there and wanting to know who's up there and mm-hmm. what are they doing. And for me as an ecologist, the big question is, how does what's going on in the canopy relate to the forest as a whole? How does this sort of subsystem of the forest, this forest canopy piece, interact with the rest of the forest? And so those are the kinds of questions that have been driving me for these last 35 years to get grants, to write papers, to have graduate students, to interact with colleagues, to explore this really formally very poorly known part of our biosphere. And there's still so many questions to ask up there. And, you know, I've got graduate students who are asking different questions or questions that build on my questions. And really kind of a network now of canopy researchers who are trying to understand what we call the last biotic frontier on our planet. And it has been an exciting gift, really, to be one of the first people, one of the first pioneers to really explore that frontier. And what I'm so delighted about, Mel, is that it's no longer a frontier. There's lots now that we know about it that we didn't know 30 years ago. And it's just now being sort of, I think, be being incorporated into our understanding of the forest as a whole, to the extent that people don't even call themselves canopy biologists anymore. They just call themselves forest biologists, even if they're studying in the canopy. So I've been really blessed, I think, to see the development of the whole field of ecology, this field of forest canopy studies that has evolved over the last 30 years to change one part of our biosphere from being a black hole where we didn't know anything about it to being lit up by knowledge, scientific knowledge of this amazing, diverse, you know, ecologically important piece of the forest. And I guess that's what drives my passion to share it, because, you know, when you find something new, you want to show it to somebody else.
Absolutely.
And you want to show it to everyone else. And so that's really what I think is what my life has, my professional life has been about. It's been about discovery and now sharing, and sharing not just with other scientists, but with anybody who will listen to me.
Well, I think we're quite fortunate that you have that impulse. Ah, that's wonderful. I keep hearing all the parallels back again to the work you've done throughout, and then the work now in the prison system, and again just shedding light back to places that were previously dark. You know, things we haven't understood why, right? So, or the conceptions we've had. You know, even when you're talking about treetops, to know there's all this up there, but it's been, you know, previously too hard to get up there. So, you know, similarly with incarceration, there's a lot at stake on various levels. And so, you know, people really maybe haven't gone in. So the fact, again, that you bring that back, you just seem to bring things on every single level of life in that whole spectrum.
Okay.
Yeah,
thanks.
It's really wonderful.
Thank you.
Well, maybe as a final question, I so appreciate your time with us here today. This is just really exciting. So, I'm a little bit curious too, because you talk about two parents, one more quiet and science oriented and one maybe more performative and sounds like literature and reading elements. Are there ways that you find the arts or specific readings? I mean, you bring it in so many levels. So I just wonder what other sources you also might turn to for inspiration, things along those lines.
Yeah, that's a great question. I hate to keep talking about my childhood, but another real important element in my childhood was modern dance.
Okay.
And my parents, although they were not rich, they knew that they wanted to give their kids access to the arts. And so I have two sisters and myself. So the girls in the family were given modern dance lessons with this marvelous teacher named Erica Timai, who's since passed away, but she was this really creative, energetic force in my childhood. And she believed everyone was a dancer. And she believed not only in developing techniques, but helping us kids, you know, our children in her studio, understand that we are all creative human beings. And so she inspired me and I think all the other dancers that we could express creative energy through movement. And so I was inspired through modern dance to come to understand that we're all creative beings. And I took modern dance all through college and graduate school. And I really had this sort of dilemma, actually, when I graduated from college. I double majored in biology and modern dance. I was like, how am I going to do these two things professionally? Because each of them, field biology and modern dance, really requires, you know, like a full-time commitment to make a success of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up actually trying both out the year after college. I sought and found a position as a field assistant in a remote field station in Papua New Guinea. And I traveled there and I spent a year there and I worked with biologists. I was the assistant to a beetle taxonomist. And I really sort of lived the life of a field biologist. And then I went to Paris and I found a dance studio there. And for 6 months, I just did nothing but modern dance. And I lived the life of a modern dance person as well as I could. And then after 6 months, I said, well, you know, which is it going to be, field biology or modern dance? And I read all my journals, and I decided on field biology because I felt that I loved living more in the wild than I did in the city, and the people that I encountered in biology seemed to be much more open and wonderful and connected than the people I met in modern dance. And I knew also that, you know, life of modern dance, your profession is quite short. You know, after age 30, that's it for performance in general. was in biology, you just keep going and going. So that's when I decided on a profession in forest ecology. But I always kept dance and the arts in my mind as another way of knowing, another way of expression, another way of being. And about 5 years ago, I actually got a phone call from a modern dancer named Jody Lomas. She's a choreographer, and she said, Dr. Nadkarni, I want to make a modern dance about rainforests. Wow. Can you help me? I'm like, yes, of course I can. So I brought her and her troupe down to Costa Rica to my field site. We stayed there in the rainforest for, you know, for 10 days. I taught them how to climb trees. They asked all kinds of questions. They started, composing bits and pieces of the modern dance. And when they returned to San Francisco, they made this beautiful dance called Bio about tropical rainforests. And we got some funds from different foundations to perform it in San Francisco and in Seattle. And I started it out by giving a little talk about the biology and the fragility and the importance of rainforests. And then her troupe produced or performed this amazing modern dance. And then in the lobby, we had sort of contracted with different conservation groups who offered opportunities for volunteers to help them with their conservation projects. And so the dynamic was that I sort of educated the audience about rainforests, and she inspired them with her amazing modern dance. And then there was this opportunity to do something about conservation. So I think what that represented was this really marvelous sort of potpourri of science and the arts represented by dance and then conservation, very much like what we were trying to do with the Prison Project, but with different partners. But it was really the same thing. It was about bringing knowledge through different media in order to help the earth and to help nature ultimately. And it was, I think, by far one of the most fulfilling collaborations that I've ever had, because the dancers were engaged with the sort of academic and scientific and intellectual development of this project. It wasn't just me saying, oh, I need a modern dancer to express what I already know. We were in the jungle together, and we produced this dance together. Not that I was a dancer, but that I could be in on that production and the creation of it. And so I think the arts are that way, and I've worked with poets, and I've worked with musicians, I've worked with rap singers, and I always find that bridge between natural history and science and ecology with the arts as one of the most natural connections that exist, I think, between disciplines. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a growing number of scientists and a growing number of artists that are reaching out their hands to make these connections. And I think that when it's especially in the service of trying to help society or trying to help nature, trying to help humans, I think that these art-science interactions are incredibly valuable and incredibly productive. And I think it's a very exciting sort of third state to be in, of this space between art and science that can promote a betterment of our earth and a betterment of our society.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That integrity, I keep hearing again coming back to the integrity of all life.
Yeah.
And oh, this is wonderful. You're just absolutely inspiring on all kinds of levels, and I'm really excited to have people come out further. So this talk is open to anyone?
Great.
Yes
it is.
Okay.
It totally is, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
So I think it's going to be on the campus. It's an evening talk on, I think it's November 30th.
Yes.
And I'm sure that the organizers would love to have anybody and everybody come to this lecture.
Okay, wonderful. Wonderful. That's how, that's actually how I've been telling everyone about it. So,
great.
Glad to hear. Anything else you wanted to finish with, Nalini?
I just think that, that many scientists, most scientists, I would say, spend their professional lives, in the lab or in their field site, and they don't really recognize that it's not very hard to step outside of it. I think a lot of scientists are fearful of it, or they only feel comfortable with talking with or communicating with other scientists. But I think from my own experiences, there's not only sort of an ease to reach out to other groups and to community groups and public groups, but there's actually a benefit of what comes in, that this communication can be two-way or multi-way, that when a prisoner says, I realize that we could really shift this protocol in feeding the frogs, because that's what he sort of discovered in the 8 hours a day he was spending with the frogs, that can inform a scientific or a conservation science protocol. And so this ways of knowing, I think the exchange of them is something that is really kind of the next frontier for scientists to understand. And it's not that nobody's doing it. It's just that I think we need more of it. And so I think scientists need to be maybe a little more humble or a little more open in terms mm-hmm. of understanding fully that there's something to be gained to them, to their scientific enterprise, by opening their doors to people from the outside in.
Absolutely. Again, that communication and the value of each human and then each species. I mean, it sounds like you could extend that principle out interspecies wide then, that there's always this communication.
Right.
Yeah. Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you so much for being
You're
with
welcome.
Us. And I'm absolutely looking forward to your talk, and I will look forward
great.
To really just keeping in touch with all the things you're doing down the road. So thank you
that
for
sounds
all
great.
Your work.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Okay, Nalini, you take good care.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was an interview with Dr. Nalini Nadkarni. You're listening to Yin Radio. Dr. Nadkarni will present Not Such Strange Bedfellows, bringing science, nature, and nature imagery to prisons at 7:30 p.m. in the Compton Union Building, the Cub Auditorium, on November 30th. So November 30th, coming up here, not this Monday, but the next, at the Cub Auditorium, 7:30 p.m. If you have the opportunity, come on out to hear Nalini Nadkarni. WSU is honoring her for the 2015 William Julius Wilson Award, which is an award for the advancement of social justice, and that's in recognition of her work to promote social inclusiveness of incarcerated people and to reduce post-prison joblessness and recidivism. All are welcome at this event. You can also find Dr. Nadkarni online via her two TED Talks. Life Science in Prison is a 5-minute TED Talk from 2010, and Conserving the Canopy is about 16 minutes from 2009. She has a website, NaliniNadkarni.com. That's NaliniNadkarni.com. And we're just super thankful to have had this wonderful interview with her. And again, just very excited that in terms of the giving of a social justice award, that the recognition for this work and the recognition of that ecological principle of inclusiveness, I think that's just, I suppose that just gives me more hope for our entire society. Next time on Yin, we're going to have an interview with the Venerable Thubten Shodron, Buddhist nun, author, and abbess of the Sravasti Abbey. Her books include Don't Believe Everything You Think, Open Heart, Clear Mind, Taming the Mind, Buddhism for Beginners, Working with Anger, and various works on guided meditations. I'm also excited to announce that some new Yin hosts will soon be working with me to keep this show vibrant, alive, and diverse. Eva Halvik is the one who will be traveling to the Sravasti Abbey for this interview with the Venerable Shodron. And in the new year, several more Yin hosts will be joining us. So to stay posted about the new people coming on, about upcoming shows, and in fact to find today's show and all of our other shows archived, please visit us at www.yinradioblog.wordpress.com. You can also find us on Facebook at Yin Radio. Again, my name is Tara Howe, and thanks so much for listening.